Fourier, the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has two matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 050197, Gemini Playgrounds, Inc. versus Ron Snyder from Comal County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District, and 292, State of Texas, Texas General Land Office, and the Texas Land Commissioner versus Herbert W. Holland from Matagorda County and the 13th Court of Appeals District, and I will not be sitting in that cause. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments and will take a brief recess between the two. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050197, Gemini Playgrounds versus Ron Snyder.
May it please the court, Mr. Fusselman will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for the argument.
May it please the court, counsel. This is a case about predictability and certainty in contract law. It has to do with commercial lease with an implied warranty of commercial suitability as implicated, and an as-is waiver provision that was a broad form, non-specific as-is waiver provision. It also involves what is termed as a waiver of subrogation, which wasn't ruled upon by the Court of Appeals below, but arguably could have been utilized by the trial court to grant summary judgment in this case. For that reason, we'd be addressing both of them. What I'm going to try to do first, give you a roadmap of where I'm going with the argument, and then begin looking for questions. Our first part of the argument will be that the implied warranty and the waiver of subrogation clauses are both extraordinary risk-shifting provisions. As such, they must be in writing. We're arguing that the tenancy, which the original written lease expired in 1996, 4 years before the date of loss. After that, it reverted to a month-to-month tenancy. Our argument is that since it reverted to month-to-month tenancy, the risk-shifting provisions were no longer in writing and therefore no longer enforceable as extraordinary risk-shifting provisions. Secondarily, we'll argue that to the extent that the court would disagree with us and the court would rule that the risk-shifting provisions continue to be in effect, that the language of those risk-shifting provisions were not sufficient to waive the implied warranty of suitability for commercial purposes or to waive the right to recover under the other theories, which include negligence, negligence per se, gross negligence, and again, the reach of implied warranty.
Let's assume that the provisions are enforceable here, just for purposes of argument.
Yes, sir.
We've held in the last 4 years that an implied warranty of habitability in the residential context generally cannot be waived, and you make an argument that analogously the implied warranty of suitability in a commercial context should not be waived. And we did have that statement in David Al that generally this implied warranty is not waived unless the tenant agrees to, and we use some fairly specific language. Central facilities will remain in a suitable condition, and in the lease, the tenant must expressly agree to repair certain defects. The Court of Appeals makes the point that in David L. we didn't say in that 1988 case that that's the only way that the as-is clause is going to be in effect here. What's your response to that point by the Court of Appeals?
Justice Wainwright, the Court of Appeals' opinion on that particular topic, if you'll notice, actually merged both a waiver argument and a breach argument. And while they argued, or while they wrote, that there's more than one way to waive the implied warranty of commercial suitability, certainly this court never said that. And as part of their argument, what they do is say, and in fact, let me read it for you. I marked it last night, and it's fairly confusing language when you read through it, so I'm going to try to get it as clear as I can. This is from page 12 of the original opinion. While the Supreme Court in Davidow approved one means of waiving the implied warranty of suitability, and it gave that standard. It did not state that this is the only method by which the implied warranty of suitability can be waived. Rather, the Supreme Court explicitly stated that determination of whether there has been an actionable breach, which is different from waiver, of the implied warranty of suitability depends on the particular circumstances of the case, in other words, the facts of the case. One of the factors to be considered in that analysis is whether the tenant waived the defects. And as it continues through its analysis, it gets to the end, it lists those facts, and then it says, in short, David Al indicates that there is more than one way to override or waive the implied warranty of suitability. But what it gives as its logical path to reach that conclusion is actually a mixture of proving up a breach versus waiving the right to the rights under the implied warranty of suitability.
But in the commercial context, I mean, what if somebody says, you know, if the only way you can do it is who agrees to make repairs and you got a place with no fire system and they say, you know, well, we're going to lease it, but it's going to be expensive because we got to put in a fire suppression system. So don't worry, I'm just going to store asbestos there. I don't want a fire suppression system. Let's negotiate a lower term. We do, and then it burns down, and I sue you anyway. I mean, these are grown-ups. This is not somebody going out to rent an apartment. These are grown-ups. They know what they want to do. Why should we be telling them, nope, this is who's got to put in the fire suppression system, and this is how much you got to charge for it?
The first answer to that, Justice Brister, is certainty and predictability.
Oh, sure. We could say every apartment in Houston has got to be rented for $100,000 a month. That'd be certain. It'd be predictable, and it'd have nothing to do with what courts do.
But in this case, in the Davidow opinion, that's expressly what the court said had to be done. Now, let me turn my back on you, but
no,
I
don't that's, quite, that's quite all right.
I need to grab this opinion. You know, Davidow was a doctor. Surely, if there was a sophisticated person in the world, I would argue that at least a doctor is as sophisticated as folks who run a wood treating company.
So you're not saying a doctor should know all about commercial leases and buildings and AC, are you?
Not at all. In fact, I support David. I believe that Dr. Davidow was treated correctly.
Normally, I realize things were a little different in 1988, but normally we imply terms in a contract because, number one, the parties didn't address it. And number two, if they had addressed it, we're certain what they would have said. You can do that in an apartment complex. And in Texas, as a matter of fact, if it doesn't say one thing or the other, one way or the other about air conditioning, we can imply air conditioning was required because that's just the way it is. But this is different, isn't it? Which one of those, if either, does your client meet? It wasn't addressed in the contract, but this was. And if you had addressed it, we know certainly that you would have put the risk of fire procession. I mean, why does either of those apply here?
Because the tenant or the landlord under David Dow is required to list the specific defects that the tenant is to take on. The lease agreement must list the specific defects the tenant is to be charged with, and if it doesn't list specific defects, then those defects, to the extent that the jury determines they are latent defects, are laid back on the landlord's shoulders.
So what if it's a defect that's expensive to find out, like asbestos?
I don't know, Judge. That's a question for the jury to decide whether or not that's a latent defect that breaches the implied warranty of suitability.
I'm just wondering why in Prudential you can buy it as is, but you can't lease it as is.
I think the answer to that is that when you're buying it, you obviously have the financial wherewithal to buy it. You have the financial wherewithal to have attorneys, to have inspectors look at it. You're making a final decision. And, you know, the landlord's going away. As soon as he gets his check, he's done. In this case, it's a lease. And the landlord's with me every step of the way. And if I don't do something right, he can kick me out. He can put me out of business. I'm at his beck and call in some regards under the lease. In exchange for that, since he has that power, then he also has the obligation to make sure I can use my business for what it's intended to be. And that's what Davidow says. Davidow specifically says it cannot be assumed that a commercial tenant is more knowledgeable about the quality of the structure than a residential tenant. A businessman cannot be expected to possess the expertise necessary to adequately inspect and repair the premises, and many commercial tenants lack the financial resources to hire inspectors and repairmen to assure the suitability of the premises.
Well, of course, I appreciate Judge Spear's knowledge of market conditions, but it might be out there in the market. Some people that own buildings are actually widows who had buildings left to them, and they don't know anything, and they don't have any money, and they want to get rid of this thing, but they don't want the rest of their life savings destroyed if something burns down. Sometimes, in fact, the landlord's a widow and the tenant's a big, rich corporation, even though Judge Spear seems to think it's always the other way around. It is not always the case like that, is it?
Well, I can't say it's always the case like that, Judge, but I can say that as we leave
the court. Some widows own property.
While we leave the court today.
And sometimes they lease it, and your rule is they pay for everything, period.
My rule, Judge, is that if the defects aren't expressly laid on to the tenant, then they belong to the landlord if those defects would be in breach of the implied warranty of suitability for commercial purposes. It's the landlord's structure. It's his premises. It's the landlord, in this case, Mr. Snyder's obligation to produce and provide a suitable structure, a suitable premises for carrying out the business that Jim and I was carrying out. And by the way, this isn't just a situation where he happened to be a landlord and they happened to be a tenant. Mr. Snyder actually built this business. This was Mr. Snyder's business. He built out this business to another level before he sold it to my clients and leased it to my clients. In this instance, Mr. Snyder had personal knowledge, very personal knowledge of the structure and of how it was wired, and knowledge regarding the ordinance requirement that it have a code-required sprinkler system, knowledge of his negotiations with the fire marshal to not install the code-required sprinkler system.
Well, maybe I'm mistaken, but I thought that your clients were with him for at least 6 years in that same place.
They did work for him, Justice Green, but they worked for him. They were employees. They weren't his partners.
So they weren't aware that there was no fire suppression system.
They may have been aware that there wasn't a fire suppression system. I don't know, and I don't think the record reflects whether or not they were aware of the necessity of a code-required fire protection system. Furthermore, I think you will find from the law, from a reading of the law, that it would be improper to place on the tenant the burden of bringing a premises up to code with respect to fire suppression equipment. And in fact, in David Dow, another line is, because commercial tenants often enter into short-term leases, the tenants have limited economic incentive to make any extensive repairs to their premises. In this case, for 4 years before the fire, for 48 months, we're under a month-to-month tenancy, where if my folks put in a $60,000 sprinkler system, the minute they leave or get asked to leave, which they're on notice within 30 days, they can be, it reverts back to the landlord.
In Syntex, we confirmed a broad common law implied warranty of habitability of residences. And it only took the legislature 153 days to replace the common law with a statutory scheme, which is not the shortest period of time in which they've rejected one of our opinions, but it's up there. What should we take from that, if anything, about how strong to make an implied warranty that's similar in a commercial context?
But just to tack, what I would say is that we're lawyers and we're judges and we're the court system, we're the judicial system. It's our job to make these laws apply and to administer them right up to the point where the legislature turns us around. Right now, we've got laws. If you look at drive through Austin or Houston or Dallas and look at all those windows on all those buildings, for most of them, there's a commercial lease behind them. And a lot of them are going to have the very same provisions that we have here today. A lot of them are going to come under Davidow. And depending on what you all rule in this case, it's going to determine whether or not those folks have a good lease or not. It's going to determine whether or not a landlord can leave them high and dry. It's going to determine whether or not a landlord can breach an ordinance or not get in compliance with an ordinance and leave it on the shoulders of the loss risk.
So our job here today is to specify what exactly in all commercial leases the landlord has to repair, period, or the defendant and the tenant has to repair, period. And since we know best about all leases, we're in the best position to do that.
No, Justice Brister, your job today is to stand behind David Dow and say, when the big boys get together, as you called them earlier, to make their deal, make your deal. Put it in words. Say, Mr. King, this is what you get.
Make your deal with the following exceptions. You can't do this, and you can't do this, and you can't waive that.
No, you must do this. You must say, this is what you must fix.
Same thing.
Mr. Tenant. Well, it is different. It specifically puts the tenant on notice of what they're required to do to fix the premises. And the tenant says, you know what, I accept that. It's not that far removed from when you think about it from FM
dressing. But if they don't accept that, then it's going to sit empty.
I'm sorry?
If they don't accept it, it's going to sit empty because the court says this is the only deal you can make, and they say that's not the deal we want.
It could sit empty under either scenario. I think the more important consideration is what's fair and what's predictable and what's certain with respect to commercial leases. And in this instance, what we're telling landlords, you want money for renting your premises, then you must have it ready for what it's supposed to do.
Let's get away from Davidon just for a moment and look at the as-is clause. And assuming that the tenant is not sophisticated in the law and doesn't know about Davidow, Melody Homes, and Prudential and all that. The language is the tenant accepts the premise as is. The landlord has not made and does not make any representations as to commercial suitability, physical condition, or any other matter affecting or relating to the premises, and the tenant acknowledges that no representations have been made, warranties, etc. Now, what is a tenant to think of that language? Just leaving Davidow aside for a moment, doesn't that tell a tenant who knows what condition this building is in? It could be dangerous, and I'm agreeing to lease it even given that potential danger lurking behind the walls somewhere.
My time has expired, Justice.
You'll answer that question.
I think the answer to your question is that's exactly what it tells them. Less a caveat, lessee. You don't know what you're getting. Nobody's protecting you. Nobody's telling you that you can use these premises for what I'm telling you they're good for. I'm not promising you they're good for it, but I'm leasing it, and I know that's your business because I ran that business before you did. I sold the equipment to you, and that's what happened in this case. But you're right. If you don't have Davidow and you've used as is provision, you're right. You're on your own, Teddy.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May I please the court, Ms. Molina, will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. If the issue in this case is predictability and certainty, then the Court of Appeals' opinion has to be affirmed. We view the questions as follows. Whether or not an as-is provision, this particular as-is provision, which is not general, as the petitioners keep asserting, it's a very lengthy paragraph, a good portion of which was quoted by the Chief Justice. The answer to that question, can that be waived or disclaimed? Yes, it can be.
Why does predictability require affirming the Court of Appeals opinion?
Because this lease was very lengthy. It was negotiated at arm's length. Both sides had lawyers. The record here indicates that the two individuals, Mr. Finn and Ms. Cadell, who were the principals of Gemini, they knew exactly what was in there. And Mr. Snyder was not going to lease the premises to them unless he would get those provisions. He was selling the business.
Well, I hear you talking about the specific facts of this case, but we're in a common law area, which we know is judge-made law. Either rule we announce, so long as it's clear, definitive, promotes predictability because the parties will know what the rule is. They can sit down and negotiate around it. Either there is an implied warranty that can be waived by an as-is clause, or there isn't. As long as the rule is clear, it promotes predictability, doesn't it? Either way.
Yes, but I think the law is clear that in every other context, even outside of leases, the courts of Texas have said that as-is clauses are enforceable so long as the parties are not defrauded. And they're especially enforceable when the parties are sophisticated, as these were, where they actually knew about the clauses, they were pointed out, it was explained to them.
Both parties have lawyers, and that's true. And so we would expect that the lawyers would have researched the law. And if they did, they would see that Davidow says that an implied warranty, that there's an implied warranty of suitability that means that at the inception of the lease, there are no latent defects in the facilities that are vital to the use of the premises for their intended commercial purpose, and that these essential facilities will remain in a suitable condition. That's the implied warranty in Davidow. And then they would also know that under Davidow, to waive those warranties, the parties must expressly agree that the tenant will repair certain defects. How does this as-is clause square with that background law and that limitation on the use of as-is clauses?
Well, I believe you have to look at the whole lease. And in the whole lease, in paragraph 7, it's entitled maintenance of the premises. And the tenant in this lease was given all obligations to repair and maintain it in the condition in which it was. As far as the code, the code violations that they allege, but that the record conclusively rebuts, there's a provision in the lease there as well. I believe it's 30, it's paragraph 18. Requires the tenant to comply with all ordinances, rules, and regulations. The Bynum case, which there, that involved the sale of a used house. But if we're going to enforce an as-is clause when somebody is buying a residence, then surely we would in a commercial lease. And there, Bynum said that the fact that there were code violations when some remodeling was done, there were whatever town that arose out of required a building permit, and there were no building permits obtained when the remodeling was done, that did not preclude application of the as-is clause. Nothing in this case, either factually or legally, justifies the remedy that's sought here, and that is avoidance of a lengthy, non-boilerplate, negotiated lease between three individuals, all of whom had extensive business experience.
But if we adopt the reasoning of the Court of Appeals, it's a pretty good bet this identical clause will appear in all commercial leases before long, right?
That assumes that the tenant will sign them.
Yes, but they will, in the form, they will be in almost all.
I don't think that's necessarily true, because as-is clauses have been recognized in sales for a long time, and they may be in preprinted contracts.
We'll make a side bet about that. but let's assume that it appears in most forms shortly after, if we were to adopt your conclusion. Then the deal is, when the place burns down, everybody talks to their lawyer, and the tenants say, we never noticed that there was no fire suppression system. And the landlord says, I told them that, and it all goes to a jury, and we end up leases or whatever a jury says, which sometimes may be which one of the parties they like best. Is that a good way to allocate fire losses by whichever party appears more attractive to a jury later on?
I don't think so, and that's why I say
that. How do we avoid that? I assume if we have an as-is clause, we're going to have something like the same factors we had in Prudential.
Yes.
Which then leaves it to at least one, whether somebody knew or didn't know, which is emphasized in both briefs here. And
well, I think in any contracting situation where you have great disparity between contracting parties, the law gives certain remedies and defenses. But here, I mean, I think you have to look. I know this court wants to look at the effect of its decisions,
right,
but also needs to look at the facts in which this case arose. And in this case, if the court adopted a prudential reasoning, which hasn't destroyed commercial sales,
it hasn't, period.
And so if that reasoning were adopted, the Court of Appeals decision would have to be affirmed in this case. And all we're saying is Prudential's good law, There's no reason not to extend it to commercial leases. There are statutory...
There is a distinction, of course, between lease and purchase. Your opponent is right. People do inspect things before they buy. They hire an inspector who goes in and inspect, and they, I don't know, don't usually do that with leases, do they?
No, but we're not arguing that the implied warranty of habitability should be done away with or that anything should happen to Davidow. We're just saying that it can be disclaimed under the same circumstances as are present in Prudential, and that is where you have knowledge. And here, they knew that there was not a sprinkler system. They knew about the code issue because what opposing counsel didn't bring up, which has been brought up in the brief, is that Mr. Finn was there when the fire marshal came by and the discussion about a sprinkler system was had. And he knew that the fire marshal, although he said, you know, you might want to put one in, there was a big investment there. The building was just slightly over 20,000 square feet or series of buildings. But he did not cite them for a code violation. He had some discretion, as he testified. So there's never been a finding by anybody of a code violation, and Mr. Finn knew there was no sprinkler system. So that issue wouldn't be one that would prevent application of an as-is clause. One of the factors that Prudential says you look at is were both parties represented by counsel. Here, the negotiations originally began about a year before the lease.
But again, there are material differences between a purchase and at least a short-term lease, aren't there? If there are capital improvements required, an AC system throughout a commercial building or a sprinkler system, that's not something a tenant leasing for a short term is going to want to do. It's going to be economical for the tenant to do. Certainly the owner of the property wants those capital improvements if they are. To me, they're in the nature of capital improvements done to the building. So there are material differences there. I guess our question is, do we want to make every lease have a term, as petitioners are asking, that certain essential facilities and repairs have to be expressly put on the back of the tenant for the tenant to have to do them? Or do we want the parties to just sit down knowing what the rule is and negotiate what the terms are going to be?
I think the latter rule, because, again, we are talking about commercial leases. And if you look at the cases in which this lease is implied warranty is applied, it's not exactly the same as habitability. It's suitability for the purposes, the commercial purposes for which the building is going to be used. So an unair-conditioned building might be great for storage, but a doctor wouldn't want to have his office there. Now, of course, the doctor would know it's not air-conditioned when he went there. And so why would he sign a lease? I mean, I think that the
position... But there are some conditions that the doctor won't know about. When we're talking about latent defects, there are ones that a visual inspection, they don't reveal. And there's something that the law has said the owner of the building has more information about than a potential lessee. And I think that was the reason that this all came into being, that there's more information on the landlord's side than on the tenant's or the owner's than on a potential purchaser. And so economically, the incentive, at least some of our prior cases say, the incentive ought to be on the seller or the lessor to either declare them and make provision specifically for their repair and maintenance, or the implicit warranty is in effect.
Well, I have difficulty squaring that with Prudential, because Prudential says...
How do you square it with Melody Homes and Davidow?
Those are different... Davidow doesn't say... I mean, I guess I view Davidow as saying we're going to recognize this warranty, and... They were talking about breach when they talked about waiver, but I suppose I'm trying to, maybe if we look at it this way, the implied warranty of suitability is there. unless it's disclaimed. That's not a new rule. That's not a rule that we haven't adopted in many other contexts. Melody Homes is a very specific warranty. Davidow was decided 3 months after. In Melody Homes, that warranty, the court said, you cannot disclaim this. 3 months later, Davidow is adopted, and there's no discussion of disclaimer, except to say that if the tenant waives it, there can't be a breach of it. And so that indicates to me that it not only can be waived, but that the waiver can be given effect. Here, the language is just so clear that, and again, you know, I don't want to focus too much on the facts, but the facts of this case are very clear. The individuals who signed the lease on behalf of Gemini, and they were the only owners and the only principals, they testified that they did not get they could have gotten an inspection, but they didn't because, and this is a quote, who knew the building better than us? And so, yes, I think there are circumstances where it would be grossly unfair to give effect to an as-is clause where an unknowledgeable lessor, it enters into a lease and there are misrepresentations made, and so he finds himself stuck with a building that he can't use. But that's not this case. So I suppose...
Davidow and Prudential conflict, you think?
No, because there was no as-is clause in Davidow.
Okay. But Davidow says... Davidow says there's the implied warranty, and to overcome that, then the parties must expressly agree to repair certain defects. Is that right? Mm-hmm. So how is that not... If we were to apply Davidow to this case... Does this lease require the tenant to repair certain defects?
I believe it does. It requires them to repair all of them. Keep in mind.
What language does that? As I recall from the briefing, the assertions made that there's no specific defect assigned to the in the lease to the tenant. Are you saying the general disclaimer or the disclaimer clause?
It's paragraph 7. And it says, it's attached to our brief on the merits. And it says, tenant covenants and agrees that tenant sole cost and expense to perform all maintenance and repairs of the premises and to repair or replace any damage or injury done to the premises or any part thereof caused by any reason except the gross negligence of landlord.
So all the language to perform all maintenance and repair, you believe, expressly makes the tenant responsible for the AC and for a sprinkler system?
Yes, and it goes on. I mean, I guess
this is... What about a sewer system?
I don't know who would be responsible for that, because from my personal experience, often the city and the premises owner or lessor is responsible for part of it.
My question is: does the language "the tenant's responsible to perform all maintenance and repair" include the tenant being obligated to repair a sewage system?
I think it would. Again,
so you think this language effectuates Davidow's expressly agree that the tenant will repair certain defects? That's what you're telling. That's your answer to the chief's question.
Yes, because I don't think that usual commercial leases, you know, the pre-printed forms that you get at a real estate agent's office will list out, okay, landlord's responsible for the roof, especially in a large building where you have multiple tenants. They're going to be responsible for the common areas, the roof, the air conditioning, the things that go to the building as a whole. And the tenant is going to be responsible for repairs within their own space. For example, if your office space includes restrooms and all the plumbing backs up, you have to go out and get a plumber to come fix it at your own expense. And then the tenants, if there's lots of repairs done to the building, at the end of the year, the tenants divide up some of those extra expenses, because that's in the lease as well.
So you don't distinguish between normal use repair and maintenance and capital improvements, for example. What if the sewer problem required digging up the lot with a backhoe and replacing a lot of pipes leading into the city sewer system? Would that be a tenant repair under this language, in your opinion?
Well, again, it says what it says. If it's maintenance and repairs of the premises, Mr. Snyder drove a hard bargain in this case. They wanted to purchase the business. They didn't want to purchase the premises and the equipment. So
let's compare Prudential's purchase with a long-term lease. Let's say a tenant is in a 40-year lease, and let's assume the useful lifetime of a AC system or a sprinkler system is 30, 40 years. And the tenant's probably going to, if they're being rational, say, I'm going to get the entire use of this capital improvement under my facts, so I may as well do it. It's no more cost to me in terms of my 40-year use than for the owners. But in a short-term lease, aren't there some differences between a purchase and a lease in terms of where logically perhaps the burden should sit, if we're going to put ourselves in the position of determine logically what parties should contract for?
Yes, but there again, okay, if you announce a rule that you have to list out every single possible defect or problem, or allocate every part of the building to one party or the other, there's going to be circumstances where that part's going to go out. And that's how the lower courts have dealt with these as-is clauses. There hasn't been any problem at all. The cases we cite, and even the ones they do, it was the landlord trying to get out of a big problem because he didn't comply with his obligations under the lease. So if the landlord is supposed to fix the roof, and the roof isn't fixed, and there's an as-is clause in it, I don't think that even applies. Because if the landlord has taken on the responsibility of fixing the roof, he's breached another provision of the lease. And so really the only difference here is that there's case law that says that if the warranty of suitability is breached, it's separate and apart from the obligation to pay rent. So,
are there further questions? Thank you, Ms. Molina.
Your adversary made a comment that if there was a leak in the roof and this contract had an as-is clause, and a part of the provision says that the landlord is to repair the leaks, but there's an as-is clause. Why wouldn't the as-is clause control over the responsibility that's designated to the landlord, or should it?
Justice Medina, I think that any time a special defect is placed in a contract on the shoulders of one party, that party carries that. I think in that scenario, if, for instance, there was a broad form as-is provision, but that did the reverse of what I'm saying it should do. In other words, it says, but the landlord shall repair the roof. I think the landlord would be required to repair the roof. He'd have a contractual obligation to do so.
It seems like an insurance policy, which is we cover for mold, for example, or don't cover for mold, but ensuing loss clause provides otherwise. It seems like that was the same analogy made by your adversary there, that that contract provides one area of coverage but takes it away with an as-is clause.
In another place. I think another thing to keep in mind is that there are rules of construction involving landlord-tenant leases in commercial context. One of them is if there is an ambiguity in the lease, it has to be construed against the landlord if the landlord created the lease and then tendered it to the tenant for the tenant's acceptance or rejection.
But that's not what you have here.
But in this case, that is what we have. In this case, Mr. Snyder presented my clients with the lease. They took it to a lawyer. The lawyer says this is highly in favor of Mr. Snyder. And then my folks said, we need the space. And they signed the lease. And that's part of the sophistication argument that the defendant makes. And I think that's important because let's remember something about sophistication. That's a question of fact. And this is a summary judgment case.
Well, let's go back to ambiguity or no ambiguity. The disclaimer clause also says landlord makes no other warranties expressed or implied of merchantability, marketability, fitness, or suitability.
Yes, Your Honor. But in this instance, that
why isn't that the end of the story?
Because David Dow says it's not. David Dow says, irrespective of what warranties you
David Dow says that for essential facilities, that they will remain in a suitable condition.
That's correct.
What are essential facilities?
The facilities necessary to do the work of the business.
So an AC is necessary in Brownsville.
True.
Is it necessary in North Texas in September?
Maybe or maybe not. It's a fact question for the jury to decide.
And Davidow then says the parties to a lease expressly agree that the tenant will repair certain defects. What are certain defects?
And that's exactly right. It's not just a specific.
How clear is Davidow?
I think Davidow is very clear. It says certain defects. And certainty means.
Well, you just agreed. You just said that essential facilities depends upon a jury verdict. That's a fact question.
That's right.
Jury. So how, I mean, that doesn't seem to sit well with your statement that Davidow is very clear. And on the other hand, say that to determine what essential facility means, we have to ask a jury. Those two don't fit in the same logical construct.
Justice Wainwright, it's the difference between waiver and breach. The waiver issue, according to Gober versus Wright, which is a writ denied case, is a matter of law for the court to decide. The breach of the implied warranty is a matter of fact for a jury to decide. And whether or not that would constitute an essential facility in Brownsville or up in Amarillo would be a question of fact for the jury to decide. What the court would decide is whether or not the waiver reached far enough to include the failure to provide that particular.
Well, anytime there are disputed facts, material facts, those are questions for the jury. I'm talking about reading Davidow that says essential facilities will remain in a suitable condition. And then it says that the tenant's responsible if expressly agreed for certain defects.
Exactly.
And I'm just asking, how clear is Davidow? How much does Davidow say? I'm frankly not sure how much Davidow says.
To me, it's clear.
And Davidow didn't address an as-is clause either.
Well, it didn't address an as-is clause. And in fact, it said what you must do is specify certain defects that are the responsibility of the tenant. And an as-is clause doesn't do that. You know, as a matter of fact, in the Lee versus Perez case, I know that Justice Brister is familiar with it, there was an issue about whether or not, I think it was a deed restriction, constituted a latent defect that was protected under the implied warranty of suitability. And in that case, it was determined, I believe, that it was. But I do want to, before I know my time's almost up, I just want to really get across the point that this is a fact-intensive case. And this is a summary judgment granted by the trial court and affirmed on appeal, and we're up here talking about factors. All the words we heard were factors. Those are facts. Those are facts for the juries to decide. My time's expired.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.